Although he began studying Spinoza as part of a group of philosophers led by Louis Althusser in the 1950s in Paris, he then proceeded to carefully develop his own and unique interpretation of Spinoza's philosophy, seeking to understand him as a precursor of Marx. Due to the fact that his two main books, Individual and Community in Spinoza from 69 and Spinoza and the Salvation of the Ignorance from 71, have not yet been published into any language, his philosophical work remains isolated as something researched only by French readers, Spinoza scholars, and extremely understudied in its own philosophical right, as compared to, for example, the work of other celebrated Marxist Spinoza scholars such as Étienne Balibar, Pierre Macheret, Antonio Negri, or Althusser himself. Materon's work is a link in a long chain of Spinoza commentators in France. In an interview published in 2000, Materon points out that when he started studying Spinoza, there was no scholarship he could support himself on, as there was really nothing on Spinoza. This blunt statement is undermined by Materon himself in the same interview, who recognizes that a very influential text for him during the preparation of his doctoral dissertation was the book by Marxist philosopher and professor at the Sorbonne, Jean Toussaint de Santy, Introduction to the History of Philosophy from 56. De Santy uses Spinoza's work as a case study to show how to develop a Marxist analysis of the history of philosophy. In saying that there was nothing he could rely on to develop his work on Spinoza, Materon probably meant that, besides De Santy, the long tradition of Spinoza commentators in France, Jean Cavallé, Victor Delbos, Sylvain Sack, etc., had not undertaken a systematic interpretation of his philosophy, linking all of the different aspects of Spinoza's opus, such as his metaphysics, epistemology, ontology, and politics. In a fairly recent work on the history of French Spinozism, Knox Beadon, this is a book from 2014, Spinoza Contra Phenomenology, is a very important book, has drawn attention to the fact that before the work of Deleuze, whose most famous study on Spinoza was published in 68, so 1 year before Materon's great book, so before Deleuze, Spinoza's work was mainly studied from an epistemological and metaphysical perspective. Thus, rationalist philosophers such as Jean Cavallé, Martial Guerou, Ferdinand Alquier primarily focus on the treatise on the amendment of the intellect and on the two first books of the ethics, on God and on the mind. Guerou's impressive two-volume commentary on the ethics is a case in point here, as it focused almost exclusively on metaphysical and epistemological aspects of Spinoza's work. Materon himself points out that during his exchanges with him, Guerou never became interested in the political aspects of Spinoza's system or in Materon's own political interpretations. Knox Beadon proposes that De Santy's work is the bridge between the tendencies interpreting Spinoza from a rationalist, methodological, and scientific perspective, like in the work of Cavallé, for example, and those who began to use Spinoza's modal theory to highlight all of his ontological implications to reflect on his concept of singularity. Here, you want to...
People can maybe move either side, or people come in.
I'll start the paragraph again. So, Beadon proposes that De Santy is the bridge between the rationalist tendencies in the interpretation of Spinoza and those, let's call them, ontological interpretations of the theory of singularity and the modes in Spinoza. So, in this tendency, we may include Deleuze and Althusser, as Knox Beadon does, but we may also include other Marxist political philosophers such as Balibar, Macheret, and Negri. So for Beadon, I quote him, De Santy occupies a mediate position between these two moments in French Spinozism, affirming Spinoza's rationalism, though hesitating to draw out the full range of its ontological implications. End of the quote. This statement is certainly correct if we consider the rationalist philosophical currents around which Beadon situates his study. But if we consider the history of Spinozism more generally, beyond anti-phenomenological tendencies which are the focus of Beadon's work, I believe it is the work of Alexander Materon, the one that establishes a bridge between perspectives that preferably focused on Spinoza's epistemology and those centered on an ontology of power, either in a non-Marxist key focusing on the role of the body, like Deleuze, or in Marxist inspired readings of Spinoza's politics, such as Balibar's and Negri's. The reason why Materon's work provides this bridge between these two tendencies lies in his interpretation of Spinoza's conatus. In Materon's work, the notion of conatus serves as a double purpose. First, it provides the vitalist and materialist basis upon which bodies may become more powerful through the establishment of linkages between other bodies, thus forming a political community, which is, for Materon, a larger individual. Second, the conatus is also the basis upon which self-knowledge may be attained through the development of human intellect. For Materon, developing knowledge means that one gets to know oneself better. Knowledge of the outside world goes hand in hand with knowledge of one's own bodily constitution. In an openly Marxist key, Materon uses the notion of alienation, a term foreign to Spinoza, in order to characterize the process that leads from knowledge through the imagination, the first kind of knowledge in Spinoza, to rational and intuitive knowledge of the essence of things, Spinoza's second and third kinds of knowledge. Thus, the alienation for Materon implies developing intellectual knowledge. In what sense is this perspective different from the work of other Marxist-inspired political thinkers? Materon recognized that De Santis' Introduction to the History of Philosophy was an influential book during the writing of his dissertation and subsequently often cited De Santis in his published articles. But there is a crucial difference between Materon and De Santis. While for Materon, the third kind of knowledge in Spinoza follows from the development of Spinoza's materialism, De Santis radically separates what he calls Spinoza's materialism from Spinoza's idealism. These are De Santis' terms. Spinoza's idealism precisely refers to the notion of a third kind of knowledge and to Spinoza's doctrine of eternity as developed especially in Ethics 5. For De Santis, Spinoza's philosophy represents, on the level of 17th century ideological superstructure, the rise of Dutch bourgeoisie. De Santis recognizes that these two tendencies in Spinoza's work, his materialism and his idealism, but does not try to purify his system, thus recognizing the tensions, or at least affirming the tensions, within his philosophical doctrine. Materon, on the other hand, does not establish these two aspects of Spinoza as a tension, but as two aspects of one and the same system contributing to human dealienation. Hence, in a rather funny moment of this 2000 interview that I was just quoting, when asked by Laurent Bove, another Spinoza scholar in France, when he was asked by Bove on how he could find interpretation in De Santis' work, considering that for the latter, for De Santis, the third kind of knowledge is something we should ditch out of Spinoza's system, Materon replies, a bit amazed, that he did not remember this aspect of De Santis' reading, and thus it was a significant oversight. If Materon's work distances from De Santis around the issue of the intellectual aspects of Spinoza's work, his rift between with regard to Balibar and Negri are perhaps even more acute. In the work of Negri and Balibar, there is a tendency to explicitly leave aside Spinoza's epistemology and more specifically his intellectualism in order to rescue a theory about the power of the body and the multitude without the need of going through the development of eternal ideas. In a very brief note on individual and community in Spinoza, this book by Negri, in a note on this book, Balibar points out that in his important and influential book, Spinoza and Politics, Balibar has traversed the opposite way Materon has proposed in order to write an introduction to Spinoza's politics. While Materon starts out with the ethics, then to move into Spinoza's political works, Balibar has taken the risk, this is what he says, of beginning with the political treatise, then the theological political treatise, then to move into a commentary of the ethics. I believe this passing note hides a very important methodological difference between Balibar and Materon. By beginning with a commentary on Spinoza's political works and then reading the Ethics in light of these political treatises, this allows Balibar to provide an introduction to Spinoza without going through Spinoza's intellectualism as a central aspect within his system. This method allows to undertake a study of Spinoza's politics without considering what de Santis dubbed the idealist tendencies in Spinoza's doctrine and what Balibar himself, in other texts, considered as the most surprising and elitist contradictions of Spinoza. Something similar happens in relation to Negri. Although Materon praised Negri's interpretation of Spinoza in the preface to the French edition of The Savage Anomaly, he also draws attention to the fact that Negri does not take seriously Spinoza's geometrical method. Materon thus implicitly states that for Negri, Spinoza's rational method is nothing but a hangover from the modern philosophical bourgeois milieu within which he wrote and lived. Such a criticism towards Negri is not unexpected because Negri himself is probably one of the commentators that most clearly distinguishes between two tendencies in Spinoza's work and explicitly attempts to leave aside his intellectualism, which he deems as an immanent pantheism. In the context of the Ethics, Negri argues that books 1, 2, and 3 represent these intellectualist tendencies. On the contrary, the political treatise, Spinoza's final writing, would express the more mature and highest development of his philosophical system anchored around the concept of the multitude and on a metaphysics of power. Thus, unlike Materon, de Santis, Negri, and Balibar explicitly or implicitly divide up the work of Spinoza into two tendencies. While de Santis recognizes that these two aspects of Spinoza's work are the product of contradictions at the level of the economic and social structure of his time, Negri and Balibar openly attempt to purify Spinoza's system from its non-materialistic tendencies in order to establish a politics or a political interpretation based on trans-individual relationships and on the power of the multitude. Against these anti-intellectualist tendencies in the interpretation of Spinoza, Materon opts not for a purification of his doctrine, but for a unification of these two tendencies described by de Santis. In Materon, Spinoza's intellectualism, what de Santis called his idealism, blends with his materialism. This linkage between the two tendencies lies in the concept of the conatus, the essence of living beings, all of which must necessarily have a material rooting, because they all need a body. In addition, this conatus, materially inscribed at the level of duration, is linked to its own eternal essence, and this is why knowing one's own conatus is equivalent for the soul to knowing one's eternal essence. The process of dealienation is that complete only by producing a true and eternal idea of one's own essence, which, by the same token, implies a knowledge of the actual and material nature of such an essence. Furthermore, the production of a true idea is therefore an instance of human liberation, not only because it contributes to the singular dealienation of one's own singular individuality, but there is also a practical dimension in the idea of the sage for Materon. Multiplying and sharing one's knowledge would contribute to the self-knowledge and liberation of other people and to the material constitution of better constructed social organizations. Therefore, the material, concrete, and collective aspects of Spinoza's works emphasized by authors such as de Santis, Balibar, and Negri are all maintained in Materon without the need to sideline Spinoza's intellectual tendencies or intellectualist tendencies. In other words, and I'm concluding with this. In other words, in Materon, being a sage, being a wise man, being a philosopher even, means to engage politically. Knowledge has a practical aspect in the construction of better political organizations. This practical conception of the development of reason explains, at least partly, His enigmatic reference to Mao when asked about the relevance given to Spinoza's third kind of knowledge in his work. And this is the, I finish with this quote. I quote Materon. "It's true. I tended to think that the third kind of knowledge prefigured what Mao Zedong had called the practical phase of knowledge. And to also think in the same way that Spinoza's eternity prefigured militant life, which seemed to me as the best example of the adequacy of our existence to our essence. An adequacy I was sorry I myself could not accomplish, because in fact I was a very bad militant. Happily for me, this did not last long. But I understood from the beginning that the third kind of knowledge was not only something in Spinoza's system, but something that could be lived and that could be and that could really offer us a kind of salvation." Thank you.
First, I have to clarify something about the title. It's very bad, actually, because what I mean here is not minority in the sense of quantity, it's minority in the sense of immaturity or incompetence. So it's about the postulate of, it's about the discourse of minority, which means the discourse that says that people is always minor, so immature. Childhood represents in modern political thought the image par excellence of alienation. The child is therefore the opposite of the emancipated person. In this sense, I must refer to the Latin word emancipatio, derived from the verb emancipare, from the expression ex manus capere, which literally means to take off hands. In Roman law, these referred to the figure of the slave as well as to that of the infant under the rule of the paterfamilias. Indeed, the child is the one who does not speak, so infants. In German language, maturity and civil responsibility are associated with speaking, with having the floor, whose words mündig and unmündig bring together both meanings. Accordingly, it can be said that to emancipate oneself means to have a voice, to have a saying in both the political realm as well as regarding a person's civil rights. Those whose voice is not heard, whose voice is regarded as mere noise, these are the non-emancipated, the dispossessed. About them, it can be equally said they cannot speak because they lack judgment, and they lack judgment because they cannot speak. According to Hannah Arendt, arche used to mean for the Greek both meaning and ruling. Both meanings could be easily connected to signify the rule of those who came first. This identification of meanings at the root of the arche has effects both in the household, the domination of the parents and masters, and in the polis, the domination of the elder, as well as the domination of older social groups. Moreover, Plato sustains that only those with the adequate dispositions to rule, which are those who know, should govern those who do, and therefore do not know. Accordingly, as pointed by Arendt, it follows from Plato's argumentation a separation between knowing, which is proper of the ruler, and doing, which is proper of the ruled. Separation that we find in Plato's description of the ideal city in the Republic. And so domination over children is also justified by Locke, considering the fact that children cannot understand laws of nature. This argument can be extended to a collective level if we read Emmanuel Sieyès, as he proclaims that the multitude behaves usually like a child whenever it is invited to take part in political affairs. I quote, I could say yes. But the social mechanism is always a toy in the hands of the always childish multitude. End of quote. Sayas's judgment about the poor political abilities of the multitude in connection with its childish nature reflects the opinion that the multitude must not rule, but instead be ruled. In fact, Sayas's statement must be read in connection with the distinction between people and multitude, which we find in authors like Hobbes, for instance. But I cannot talk about that right now. Political domination as well as political submission can be, therefore, connected to a difference in knowledge. A similar problematic can be identified in Immanuel Kant's account of the Aufklärung as, I quote, departure of the human being from its self-incurred minority, or Unmündigkeit, end of quote. Here Kant refers to a self-incurred immaturity, a state of infancy. Kant resumes the discussion regarding the problem of voluntary servitude from Etienne Laboissy, which he connects to the question of Unmündigkeit. Even if revolution may eventually destroy tyranny, it cannot eliminate the combination of prejudices and ignorance that gave rise to servitude. It cannot eliminate alienation. We can identify the same problems in Heinrich Heine, who affirmed the superiority of the intellectual transformation that took place in Germany's Aufklärung, vis-à-vis the French Revolution, for the second resulted in a material change, while the first was a change in the subjective dimension of the human being, a change that could free us from self-inflicted minority. This argument we find in Heine's History of Religion and Philosophy in Germany. So minority implied two series of effects. On the one hand, minority was the reason human societies could never afford not being ruled. On the other, connected to the problematic of human liberation, minority consisted in the most fundamental obstacle to emancipation. In any case, emancipation was only possible after minority. In fact, minority was precisely that whose elimination defined emancipation. Conceived under such perspective, emancipation could only be conceived as a process, but a process in which its result differs qualitatively and radically from the process itself. This is precisely the first dimension identified by Ernesto Laclau concerning emancipation. I quote, between the emancipatory moment and the order which has preceded it, there is an absolute chasm, a discontinuity, end of quote. In this sense, it can be said that minority produces an effect of dichotomy in emancipation. Jacques Rancière's approach consists precisely in attacking such an effect. In his view, emancipation must be posited as an axiom, insofar as nothing can justify the inequality of individuals. We must state equality since the beginning, because otherwise we are only going to confirm inequality. Criticizing Pierre Bourdieu, Rancière criticizes what he calls the circle of social sciences. I quote, the oppressed are excluded because they don't know why they are excluded, and they don't know why they are excluded because they are excluded. This, end of quote. This interpretation can be justified in view of two arguments we find in Bourdieu. First, in Les Héritiers, working class youth are excluded from the university because they are unaware of the social mechanisms for which they are excluded. And second, their ignorance of from La Reproduction, their ignorance of the true reasons for which they are excluded is a structural effect produced by the very existence of the system that excludes them, end of quote. So, according to Rancière, there can be no title that justifies the fact that some should rule and others should obey. If knowledge is the ultimate title of power, minority or immaturity is the ultimate title of obedience in political theory. Even revolutionary theories could not avoid some sort of compromise with the paradigm of minority, as is the case in Marx's account on Lumpenproletariat, or his view on the populations in the colonies at his time. So such axiomatic nature of emancipation that refuse any sort of compromise with the perspective of minority allow us to restate the importance of the democratic principle of polypragmosyne, which means fundamentally that every citizen is politically competent. So what is the solution for this discourse of minority, or which we can also name an ideology of competence if we follow Brazilian author Marilena Chaui? Restate people's political maturity competence. For a Brazilian that has witnessed the rise of an extreme right movement by democratic means with high doses of manipulation, it's true, but it is not the case here. So this rise of an extreme right movement by democratic means, incorporating the election of Jair Bolsonaro, this political bet, the bet on the people's political competence, must be analyzed with a lot of prudence. Is it prudent, after all, to trust people's political abilities? As a Spinoza scholar, I could demand for myself to be even more prudent, as Spinoza himself has witnessed to what extremes people's superstition and destructive passions can lead. As an angry mob of Dutchmen murdered, mutilated, and Johan de Witt, a grand personage of the Republic of the United Provinces, and his brother Cornelis. In fact, as Spinoza states, I quote, people can be deceived so that they will fight for slavery as they would for their survival. End of quote. Is it not such confusing the very product of people's immaturity? Why would Spinoza say that it is imprudent, I quote, to try to remove a tyrant from their midst when they, the people, can't remove the causes of the princes being a tyrant? Can't we refer both passages to Spinoza's mistrust towards people's political maturity and competence? So, sometimes it sounds so fake because it's no. So in this sense, I feel compelled to refer to the problem of childhood in Spinoza. Childhood is in Spinoza a state characterized by the lack of power, as stated in the Ethics, I think we can side with François Zurabishvili, who in this matter emphasizes how Spinoza conceives childhood as the burst of the power of acting. Childhood implies a dialectical process of equilibration between power and lack of power. But the question remains, how can childhood and its corollaries, imagination and passive affects, be aligned with an emancipatory project? My opinion, the most fruitful answer has been delivered by Laurent Bov, another Spinoza scholar who, like Zurabishvili, insisted very early on the problematic of childhood in Spinoza. Instead of postulating a direct passage from the child's innate lack of power to the highest form of knowledge, Bov argues that for the existence of a passive path regarding the constitution of individual power of acting. Even passive effects can nourish and ultimately lead to the development of reason. However, this is not something that can be attained by any effect in any given circumstance. Bov emphasized that there is just one effect that can lead to this result, hilaritas, which has been translated by Edwin Curley as cheerfulness, but here stick to the suggestion of Hazana Sharp, who translate hilaritas as elation. Elation, according to Spinoza, is a specific kind of passive affect that, contrary to any other affect of its kind, does not lead to excess, but rather to a state of equilibration by which all parts of a person, of the person's mind and body, are equally and positively affected. If affectivity can never be put aside, we cannot neglect, however, the problem of imagination. In fact, Spinoza never wished to abolish imagination or religion from the collective life. He learned from Moses that religion can be socially useful. It can expand the democratic forms of a collectivity, even there where prevails the rudest superstitions. Here, imagination and memory can be reshaped as an external imitation of reason, as proposed by Yirmiyahu Yovel, In fact, this argument can be found in ethics itself, in as much as Spinoza advocates in Ethics 5, Proposition 10, the establishment of a practical program capable of directing those who still cannot be guided by their own rationality. So, quoting, I'm just finishing. The best thing, then, that we can do, so long as we do not have perfect knowledge of our effects, is to conceive a correct principle of living or sure maxims of life, to commit them to memory and to apply them constantly to the particular cases frequently encountered in life. In this case, our imagination will be extensively affected by them, and we shall always have them ready. In this case, a pedagogy based on elation can only take place if it's also at the same time a reorganization of memory. Such a pedagogy implies that we reconfigure and reconnect memories so that the body of the child and or the collectivity can become and can affect itself in increasingly more rational and useful ways to their own freedom. A Spinozist education in this sense cannot be conceived as a mere exchange of knowledge, as if those who are educated could be conceived as simple receiver of information. It can only be conceived as an affective education in two complementary ways. One, knowledge must speak to the one that is educated, and two, knowledge must recruit affects to produce more knowledge, that is, connect to the affects and the memories of the one that is educated. Knowledge must produce a body capable of being increasingly more affected by knowledge. In view of these arguments, I believe Spinoza can help in the constitution of an immanent exit from a self-incurred minority of or immaturity. Become active does not consist in the disqualification of people. It does not restore the discourse of minority. Instead, a Spinozist education is based in minority, not to disqualify it, but to demonstrate that every project of emancipation must be conceived as anthropogenesis, that is, as the development of the humanity of people out of people's concrete modes of existence. Minority is not simply something to be eliminated, but the matter of emancipation itself. For while imagination and passive effects can never be eliminated, they can play a positive role in emancipatory projects, giving consistency and duration for such. Yes, it's not a question of liberating knowledge from effects. An active body is not disaffected, a body that becomes increasingly sensitive to power. Connected to the problems of anthropogenesis, minority opens to us the problematic of an effective education, a cultural revolution in form of pedagogy. It should be in the same line of Mao's reference in Matterhorn. Thank you for your attention.
Right now.
I'm going to talk a little bit about order and the way to put things. I suppose that's the proper thing. But through the contingency, or I should be number three. That's the true order of the universe. But I wanted to open up saying, I'm a total dilettante. I don't know very much about Spinoza, so you're going to look at or hear some of the things I say and say, Craig, you're full of shit, and that's fine. You can tell me that. I've also been working in a labor union for 3 years, so the cobwebs are here, and so some of this might be like, what do you mean? It might be a little bit foggy, so I apologize. For that. But I have a 17-page paper that's got like Schelling and Hegel and all this stuff on Spinoza, and I'm going to boil it down to kind of one point that I wanted to share that kind of gave me that aha moment when I was writing my dissertation. And I was writing on Zizek and Marx, and you may be surprised to hear that I'm of the opinion that if you take into account the labor theory of value in Zizek's work, he's actually got a pretty solid ontology that makes sense all the way through, and everyone's critiques of him are baloney. So if you read Zizek as a Marxian, actually a lot of it makes a lot more sense than people give him credit for. But in trying to work through that, I was trying to figure out what the hell form actually meant. Commodity form, value form, wage form. Everyone talks about all forms. No one can say what form actually is in a succinct kind of way. And so I had to embark on that journey as part of a way to ground a moral political philosophy, or more to the point, a material philosophy of politics. And I think Spinoza can help a little bit with that when we go through a Soviet philosopher named Evald Ilyinikov. And I think what he does, or one of his central concerns is to talk about the ideal, or what he calls the ideal, thinking that's material, or thinking with the body. And he's, of course, thinking of value, exchanging commodities. There's this immaterial thing that is material. How do we conceive of this? And he's concerned with showing the philosophical genesis of Marx, so he's going through the German idealists. So Spinoza's an obvious place to go for him because of their influence on the German idealists. And because, of course, he's talking about thought and being as being the same thing. The two attributes, of course, that Spinoza talks about. And I think Ilyinkov comes to something of an elegant solution to the question of what form is, and this is why I had this kind of aha moment. But you're also going to say that's not Spinoza at all, and this is what I'm saying. I'm a dilettante. I'm talking about the Soviet philosopher's version of Spinoza that helps us think about Marx. So we're maybe a little bit far from Spinoza, but we'll get there. And what Ilyinkov does is he looks at Spinoza's discussion, very, very brief description of circles in the treatise on the emendation of the intellect. And what Ilyinkov does is describe a Spinoza who refuses just to describe the properties of a thing. Instead, what Spinoza wants to do is describe the genesis of the thing based on one of the properties of the thing, this imminent kind of discussion of what the thing is. So he's looking for the genetic root of the object being within the object. So again, the example is from Spinoza, from the emendation of the intellect, is the circle. And what is the genetic element of the circle? It's the radius. So from the radius, you can get every other property of the circle. The diameter, of course, is 2 times the radius. Circumference is 2 times pi times the radius. Pi is just the radius, of the circumference to the diameter. Area is pi times the radius squared. So you can get every property of a circle is related to the radius. It's the base element of the circle. But that's not quite it. That doesn't describe how the radius creates a circle. How is it the genesis of a circle? And so what Spinoza actually says in the emendation is that a circle is, and I'm quoting here, a line of which one end is fixed and the other is movable. So it's not just that the radius is there and you can deduct all the mathematical properties of a circle from it, it's that the circle is actually a radius in motion. And so if we go in kind of a, if I put this in kind of pathetic ways, God is like a cat who's whacked the end of this string and it's fixed on one end, so it made a circle. So what Ilyinkov, of course, seizes on here is that the genesis of the thing is coming from within the thing, but it's also a motion and an action. So he makes a big deal out of this. So to crudely summarize, and this is where this Spinozists in the room are going to cringe, I think, he argues that drawing a circle is to know a circle. So you become a circle in moving your hand in a certain way. So the practice is the source of the ideal. So again, you can see the obvious link there to commodity exchange and value. There is no value in anything on any of the tables in front of us, and there never was. There's only the act of exchanging those things for money, and that's how that value comes to be. It's in the action of exchange, and that value, of course, put in there by labor power. But this is probably not what Spinoza's talking about when he's talking about the circle, right? This is Ilyinkov's take on the circle of action and all these sorts of things. But this should help, it would help me anyway, talking about what form is. And I think a lot of these things will sound familiar if you're familiar with Marx. You'll start to say, oh, Marx was actually, or Spinoza's in some of the things that he's doing. So, of course, in money, you get one body that's taking on the ideal or taking on the universal form of another body, right? So money represents anything in the room. You can trade it for that. One body becomes the other, the body of the other, the universal essence of the other body. Again, in Marx, the Brandrissa ends with the discussion of the commodity form, but then Marx discovers, oh, I've put it in the totally wrong order. To fully unfold capitalism, you've got to put the commodity form at the beginning, and everything folds away from that. You can deduct all forms of capital if you start with commodity form, because that gives you labor power in the wage form, which gives you surplus value, which is the essence of capitalism and what causes it to move and all these sorts of things. And maybe this one is maybe even more so in the Spinoza vein. This is from the introduction from the Grandrissa. And so this, of course, solved problems for me in terms of method. You take something of the world, but then you've got to deal with its historical appearance. You take it in its historical sequence, its contingent sequence as it appears to us, or do you take it in its it's more universal sequence. And Marx had this to say in the introduction to Grand Rissa: it would be unfeasible and wrong to let the economic categories follow one another in the same sequence as that in which they were historically decisive. Their sequence is determined, rather, by their relation to one another in modern bourgeois society, which is precisely the opposite of which seems to be their natural order, or which corresponds to their historical development. So again, you've got money going way back in time. This role that it plays in capitalism is decisive and allows you to understand all the other aspects of capitalism and to differentiate capitalism as a mode of production from feudalism or whatever else. When you put money in its proper place in the intellectual reconstruction of capital, you understand it much better. And this is, of course, where Spinoza's commentators take issue with Ilyankov's reading of Spinoza's circle. First, Ilyankov's emphasis on one body acting as the essence of another body isn't the rational, it's the imaginary. So a body will have an effect on your body, and that conjures an image for you, and you think with that image. That's the imaginary, not the rational, and Ilyankov is trying to say that this is the rational. Second, no one reads Spinoza as saying that one body can take on the universal nature of another body, so this is a totally anachronistic reading of Spinoza. And maybe the big killer here is that this violates the dual attribute universe of Spinoza, where being and thinking are the same thing, but they're never directly related in that way. They're almost on two exactly separate planes, and you're just trying to figure out the right order of all the elements to say how they fit together, but never touch. So on the first point, I think this critic is correct. Ilyankov is talking about the imaginary, but he's putting a twist on it. I'll get on to that in a second. I think on the second point, where he's saying no one talks about Spinoza in this way, I think he's wrong. I found only two examples, so maybe it's not a very popular reading or whatnot, one people give often. But maybe people will recognize this, I don't know. It comes under the heading Memories of a Spinozist, and is in reference to Freud's discussion of little Hans, one of his case studies where the little boy has these symptoms in relation to a horse. And the quote is, "It's not a question of imitating a horse, playing a horse, identifying with one, or even experiencing feelings of pity or sympathy. Neither does it have to do with an objective analogy between assemblages. The question is whether little Hans can endow his own elements with the relations of movement and rest, the affects that would make it become horse, forms and subjects aside." This is, of course, Deleuze and Guattari in Thousand Plateaus, becoming animal, becoming your body takes on characteristics of another. So I would say that kind of is a reading of Spinoza that sees acting as another body as something that's actually in the Spinozist universe. But I think more to the point is that there's a conflation there with the imaginary and the rational, because Ilyankov is describing something that doesn't easily fit into the realm of the rational or even fit into the realm of the imaginary, because you have this thing called value that's somewhere in between. There's a phenomenon in the universe that is material, but somehow immaterial at the same time. Value, Marx writes, you pick up a commodity, twist and turn it all you'll like, you'll never find an ounce of value, because it's in the social relation and not in the object itself. So the value is real, it has real effects. 2008, economies crumbling, people losing their homes, all these sorts of things. It has real material weight, but is it imaginary? Partially. Is it material? Partially. Is it rational? I would say no, and this is where form comes back into it. And I think maybe we can turn to Marx again in a letter to Ruge, where he says, the world is always, there's always reason in the world, but it's not always in a rational form. And so we have something that's material, we have something that's intelligible, we have something that is, in some ways, imaginary, but it's not in rational forms. We get back to that question of form, what is form? And it's a way of doing things and arranging things to create immaterial stuff like value. And of course, where this would go from here, if I was to talk about the rest of the paper, and where Ilyankov would go, or could have gone, had he not lived in a Stalinist universe, but we want to talk about freedom, because this is, of course, Spinoza, the German idealist, they're all about freedom. Zizek, of course, picks up on all this and takes the kind of Lukacian arc, where if you begin with the material world is organized with the commodity form, you've got to replace that particular activity with a different activity, and that is, of course, the party form, which is Lukács' history of class consciousness, and Zizek's Leninist turn and whatnot, and talking about the party, which is then later done in Jody Dean does strange things with this. I totally disagree with and don't think Matt Chan and Ejax have another point. But that's all I wanted to share was I had that aha moment of, oh, forum just means a way of doing something that gives organization there. You know? And people are nodding, so maybe that was obvious to everyone, but it wasn't obvious to me. It took me a long time to get there, and I just thought maybe you would enjoy hearing me talk about that. Maybe not. But regardless, that's all I
have to say. Thank you very much, Greg.
Okay, just a short remark. I'm going to be presenting this paper, but me and Anna, we've together written this paper, so we'll tackle all the questions together. Okay, without further ado, in his analysis of primitive accumulation, Marx emphasized that the expropriation of the worker from land and means of production that enabled the development of capitalism took place in a classical form in England. However, instead of focusing on the triumphal advent of capitalism, we propose to focus on the autonomy of the resistance of the proto-proletarians. We follow the path of autonomist Marxism, which recognizes the unrelenting importance of the processes of primitive accumulation. Primitive accumulation is thus not only a story on the origins of capitalism, but it reveals the very modus operandi of capital, according to which, even today, albeit in changed forms, capital strives to subordinate to itself its outside. Thus, the more pressing and urgent question is to look at the obstacles that capitalism encounters in its path of development and regain the political potential that lingers in the history of the emerging relationship between capital and labor. Such attempts had already appeared, primarily when the primitive accumulation was not examined through the prism of teleological closure, but a contingent process, which outcome was not predetermined. We think here, for example, about Althusser's work on aleatory materialism or Silvia Federici's work in form of the book Caliban and Witch. Thanks to those scholars, it becomes apparent that the proletarian side was in fact a carrier of radical visions of equality. And, as in the case of the Warwick School, attention is drawn to the constant vitality of proto-proletarian resistance that prevented the total reign of capital. From the works of historians such as Peter Linebaugh or Marcus Rediker, we know that alongside efforts to impose a relation of servitude, a communist desire was present that manifested itself in the proto-proletarian struggle to reclaim means of production and recreate spaces of the reproduction. This problem refers us to what Michael Lebovitz called a double perspective on the capitalist mode of production. The first perspective comes to the fore when Marx views the capitalist mode of production from the standpoint of capital itself and attempts to uncover its general laws of motion. The second one, when Marx shifts his perspective and views the capitalist mode of production from the point of view of the producer. After all, the very relation between capital and living labor is purely conflictual. In that sense, it is not the universal laws of development that push the capitalist endeavor forward, but the struggle for domination and corresponding resistance. This conflict, however, is by no means a zero-sum game. It perpetually produces a surplus in a form of a desire for liberation that continually threatens the capitalist rule. As we will argue, it is Spinoza who helps us to uncover this second perspective, which unfortunately all too often disappears from Marx's analysis in favor of the point of view of capital. Thus, our inquiry primarily focuses on theoretical questions, namely the importance of the production of subjectivity in the processes of primitive accumulation. We want to show that primitive accumulation not only leads to destroying old forms of subjectivity and creating new ones essential for the development of capitalism, but also to maintaining the existence of a surplus, escaping total subordination and avoiding pitfalls of capitalist relations. Therefore, we decided to look at the resistance as a creative process of reorganizing relations, creating new forms of coexistence, opposing the capitalist order in the name of a different way of perceiving social relations. To shed new light on the problem of subjectivity and the ability to continuously create heterogeneous modes of coexistence, we decided to gain a foothold in Benedict Spinoza's philosophy. If Marx, in his criticism of political economy, adopts some of its notions only to turn them upside down later on, Spinoza's inquiry would supplement Marx's perspective by criticizing the forms of subjectivity of classical political economy and bringing into focus the collective powers that try to escape the capitalism domination at its very emergence. By doing so, it is Spinoza who gives us the missing insight into the dynamics of struggle connected to the installation of a capitalist relation.
One of the conditions necessary for maintaining the capitalist dominance is, alongside the exploitation of workers, reproduction of the relation of the servitude. Although a lot of Marx's attentions go to the exploitation in and of itself, the other aspect, the reproduction of relation of servitude, also appears in his analysis. By servitude, we mean steering one's desires in such a way that they would serve capital's self-valorization. In a sense, it is an attempt to naturalize capitalist relations. For Marx himself, it was apparent that the process of primitive accumulation contains more subtle mechanism than the brute force of repressive apparatuses of the state, which, in the interest of capital, disciplined and penalized expropriated masses. Parallelly, a different process occurs, which, after Jason Reed, we can call a normalizing one. That is why, in the course of his argument in Das Kapital, Marx says that, and this is a quote from Kapital, the advance of capitalist production develops a working class, which by education, tradition, habit, looks upon the conditions of that mode of production as self-evident laws of nature. The organization of the capitalist process of production, once fully developed, breaks down all resistance. Therefore, capital strives to establish itself as something natural and pre-imposed. Because of that, the production and reproduction of capitalist relation is both a prevalent assumption in Marxian thought, a precondition for capitalist existence, and the aim of the whole Marxian project, as it is an effort toward thinking beyond the capitalist horizon. Although Marx recognized this tendency, it was left relatively undeveloped in his thought as well as in the work of his successors. It is only Louis Althusser and his inquiries that provide a testimony to the importance of subjectivity production to the capital's dominance. Facing the problem of naturalization of living labor's subordination to capital, he argued that it's not enough for the worker to reproduce his labor power on the daily basis. The other necessary element is the normalizing one. In other words, the worker must also reproduce his or her servitude to the existing capitalist system. What made Althusser relevant for us is the fact that he turned to Spinoza in order to fill in the missing gaps. Namely, it's in the latter's notion of imagination that Althusser found the basis for a materialist theory of ideology that would remedy the shortcomings of ideology understood as a false consciousness. Besides, his arguments echo Spinoza's critique of the sovereign subject, or as Spinoza puts it, subjects seen as imperium in imperio. The primary mechanism allowing the reversal of causal relation and subject illusion creation, elements of fundamental importance to the theory of ideology, is counterintuitively understood imagination. In this case, imagination becomes a mechanism of establishing servitude. What Spinoza show us is that illusion of subjects' own sovereignty may mislead people and even cause them to obey other forces in conditions not dissimilar to slavery. As Hazanna Sharp noted, these conclusions contribute not only to the Althusserian notion of ideological apparatuses. We may find a similar structure in Capital itself, as the worker subject is interpolated as free and responsible subject, as one of the sides of the exchange process, whose rights equal the other side's rights. And the only aim of this interpolation is taking away the very same freedom. Contrary to Marx and Althusser, we would like to show that resistance is not broken, but ever present, that imagination may serve not only domination, but also liberation. In our opinion, Althusser, who first and foremost underlines the importance of the first two parts of the ethics, does not pay enough attention to Spinoza's reflection on the desire and the way in which bodies mutually affect one another. After all, Spinoza, in his ethics, defines imagining things that strengthen or maintain the bodied power as the primary aim of the soul. So instead of perceiving imagination as a mechanism responsible solely for people's enslavement, it's more advantageous to focus on its ambivalence. Imagination can both diminish and increase our power. Therefore, we propose following in Caroline Williams' footsteps to see imagination as a conductor of affects, which enable affect circulation. It enables communication and later on, the imitation of desire, joy, and sadness. Thus, the imagination may serve two opposing ends, subordination as well as liberation. To transform body's power into labor power, a particular concept of subjectivity needed to emerge. According to this concept, a human being is capable of transcending the natural order and subjecting it to his or her will. For that reason, many of Spinoza's contemporaries may be seen as theorists justifying the primitive accumulation processes. The notion of corporality in Descartes and Hobbes sets the stage for repeatability and automatization, then the capitalist disciplines required of the workers. In turn, in John Locke's thought, as noted by Balibar, we encounter the first modern definition of consciousness. We may sign up with the notion of possessive individual, an individual whose power is coextensive with his/her property. To put it differently, property and rights interwoven with it come to the fore. Property becomes a form of power that can be appropriated and accumulated by individuals. In the meantime, we may observe an opposite tendency in Spinoza. There is no transcendental subject here endowed with absolute free will. Everything interacts with the plane of immanence and according to the same rules. In his thought, essence is wholly redefined, formulated in relational and processual terms. What follows that is co-created and shaped by other bodies among which it exists. We may glimpse here a prefiguration of Marx's observation that he voices in the sixth thesis on Feuerbach, that human essence is the ensemble of the social relations. Following principle of relational ontology, we would call essence or individuality to be only a transitional phase, a passing disposition of power that necessarily must undergo yet another series of transformations. There is, however, one constant in Spinoza's definition of human coexistence. It's, paraphrasing Balibar, the principle of human virtue, a desire for common use of a common good. This desire is both rational, it stems from a recognition of common good and mutual usefulness of people, and affectual, as imagination conducts common affects. We argue that this particular conceptualization in Spinoza provides a solid basis for an ontological formulation of the common. Yet, it must be mentioned that this common good is by no means something fixed and constant. Based on the earlier specified elements of Spinoza's philosophy, it cannot be anything of sorts. The image of the common good is conditioned by social praxis and evolving relations, and at the same time, it's continuously changing and actualizing itself. As the common good is emerging from social relations, it may carry with it different and even conflictual meanings. Because of that, as Deluccese noted, the conflict remains at the heart of Spinoza's vision of society and politics, and imagination, as an ambivalent conductor of affects, may lead to its simmering down or opposed festering. The most interesting case would be a social conflict revolving around adverse images of coexistence and cooperation. We argue that's precisely what took place in the process of primitive accumulation, when capital strived to impose its dominance and order. It matched Dutch resistance on the part of different perceptions of common good, born out of radically different social relations. Relations focused on the common use of a common good. Although material conditions are one of the sources of this image of common good, the relations between people sharing the same image reign supreme over these conditions. The great exemplification of this is to be found in the history of the primitive accumulation in England, written from below. One of the important steps, recognized also by Marx, was eradication of the commons. The history, however, doesn't end here. Warwick's school works provide us with a multitude of examples of popular classes' resistance, vitality, and creativity. What is remarkable in this history is the unrelenting fight for realizing the image of the common good, of creating more equal and cooperative community that went not only against but beyond developing capitalist order. We want to stress the readiness of the social body of popular classes, or proletarians, to reconfigure itself, which accounts for the constant search for varied means of taking a stance, among which we can count, for example, using legal means, as well as spontaneous popular protest and act of popular justice. This is the point where Marx and Spinoza can encounter each other. As we know from both Spinoza and Althusser, the encounter can have a profound effect on both parties, that by the virtue of encountering each other, become transformed. As Marx continuously urges us to uncover the conditions of exploitation and going against them, it is Spinoza who can help us to imagine what lays beyond the capitalist order. As John Holloway noted in his seminal essay, the first sentence of the Capital so as the tension underlying Marx's project. Wealth, as the plentifulness and excessiveness of social relations, lie at its very heart. Holloway now cites a fragment from Grundrisse, I'm almost finishing, which I would like to bring to your attention. When the limited bourgeois form is stripped away, this is quoting Grundrisse and Marx, what is wealth other than the universality of human needs, capacities, pleasures, productive forces, etc., created through the universal exchange? The full development of human mastery over the forces of nature, those of so-called nature as well as humanity's own nature. The absolute working out of his creative potentialities, with no presupposition other than the previous historic development, which makes this totality of development, in example, the development of all human powers, as such the end in itself, not as measured on a predetermined yardstick. Where he does not produce himself in one specificity, but produces his totally, strives not to remain something he has become, but in an absolute movement of becoming, end of quote from Grundrisse. According to Holloway, then, the starting point of critique is in fact this productive surplus of social interactions, always transgressing the capitalist forms and measures. On the ontological plane, we may see this surplus as Spinozian desire to participate in a common good. Therefore, it's not only wealth that exceeds the commodity form, but also the individual co-created by other bodies, constantly changing and developing, which exceeds the form of possessive individualism and power seen as something multiplying by our relations with others and by finding new forms of coexistence that is manifold and richer than power expressed solely through the property. Spinoza's concept of imagination, however, showed that this communist desire is very fragile, endangered not only from outside, but also from within, as is contingent on circulating affects. Changes and transformation of the relation in which the rational and affective dimension of our socialization remain allow us to introduce a historical perspective, see how and whether these two elements in a given composition work together, enabling or restraining the absolute movement of becoming, which Mark writes about in the Grundrisse. Thank you very much.